Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I really must apologise for how long it's taken to go from the last podcast with St Anthony chatting with Chick Young into this one. However, I'm sure you'll appreciate that sometimes real life gets in the way of producing these pods. So, as I say, apologies. Anyway, following the last couple of podcasts with St Anthony chatting to John Fallon and Chick Young, I thought I would have a chat with our South American correspondent, Mr Mark Cooper, and garner his views on Celtic this season, the way they're playing, and specifically ask his opinion about one of the things that I know has frustrated a lot of fans this season, which is the current signing strategy of the club, or more appropriately, the perception that we've lost a bit of focus in the signing strategy of the club. In that chat, Mark gives us an insight in what he's doing down in deepest, darkest South America in relation to looking for football players and where he believes that Celtic could be adding some value. One of the things he said after the podcast actually was that he didn't feel he emphasised enough, and you'll hear this on the pod, about the options that are available to Celtic. They may not be able to go for the top tier of South American talent because that's getting taken up by the elite clubs, but there's certainly a tier of added value that Celtic could be bringing in of people who would want to come to Celtic and do something for the team. We also have a big cup semi-final coming up, and both Mark and I give our view despite the fact we both acknowledge that we know very little about the team that we are playing. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Mark Cooper. You know that I've been drunk a thousand times. And these should be the best days of my life. It's not what I thought it was. Damn blast. Look at my past. I'm living on my feet on a broken glass. So I am joined once again from the very distant shores of Argentina by Mr. Mark Cooper. How are you, Mark?
I'm very good, Harry. How are you getting on?
I'm excellent, thanks. Probably not as... Oh, you'll be going into autumn. Were you going into autumn?
Yeah. The last 2 weeks it's been overcast and rainy. Today's fine, but yeah, it's probably about like 18, 20 degrees and probably going down to about 15.
Whoa, as cold as that.
It's cold as 15. It's almost jumper weather.
Wait, I've just taken the dog for a walk and wished I had a woolly hat and gloves on. So, so first of all, in Argentina, are you getting to see many Celtic games?
Yeah, via Celtic TV. It's strange because about 6 months ago, Fox Sports in Argentina, they announced that they had the Scottish Premier League now. And when I first I moved into a new flat, got the satellite television installed into a new flat, and was quite looking forward to watching Celtic, even kind of incongruously with like Argentinian commentary over it, just to kind of, just out of curiosity to see what they're going to say. And then they showed the Dundee Derby, sometime around, I don't know, January or something like that. And since then, they seemingly have taken the decision, although they've bought the rights, to never show another game again.
some executive sat down one night and thought, I'm going to watch this Scottish football, put on the Dundee Derby and phoned up someone and said, this is pish, what did we do?
It's incredibly frustrating sometimes when, like, I'll get up in the morning, say game's at 8:30 in the morning, if it's a 12:30 kickoff back home, and I just out of chance, I'll kind of put it on to Fox Sports Argentina, just hoping that the TV guide is wrong and they're actually going to show Celtic away at Motherwell. And you just see the repeat of the Champions League game that has been repeated five times since the Tuesday night. And you're just like, ah, come on, come on. But so, in short, I'm just watching it via Celtic TV.
So, last couple of games. Well, so you got to see the game on Saturday against Motherwell. What was your thoughts?
It wasn't, for me, it wasn't, you know, an exceptionally good performance, but nor was it that bad either. It was a pretty standard game. Motherwell didn't have too many chances. They had a shot in the first minute or two when the guy laid it back to someone running onto the edge of the box. They had another chance in the last minute of the game when really Griffiths probably shouldn't have had a shot on goal. We should have just kept it for the last minute of injury time. Apart from that, they obviously scored the goal and they had the disallowed McDonald goal. But to be honest, you know, that isn't... It's fairly decent to kind of limit an opposition team to, you know, four attempts, one of which is offside. That's fairly decent. Going forward, first half, I thought Roberts looked good. There's one lovely little run where he cuts in from the touchline, goes into box, and his feet were really intricate in a kind of very small space, goes past two defenders. He looked pretty lively, nice little touches. I'm not Kasim Richards' biggest fan, but I thought he played better than he was usually, he had been playing previously. I thought he had an okay game, to be fair. Centre of midfield, I didn't think Brown had a great game. Didn't think Beaton had a great game. For me, their two performances throughout the season have probably been a bit of a down point for Celtic. Beaton, for me, is probably the most talented player we have, at least signed permanently at the club. And whether it be that, you know, he, for a second season running, he isn't playing Champions League football, and it's kind of difficult for him to kind of, you know, progress to the next step. It's possibly like Van Dijk for me, where Van Dijk kind of, they come to Celtic nowadays hoping to develop over three seasons and hoping that, say, at least two of those seasons are going to be in a Champions League.
Yeah, and someone can see him playing Champions League football, and yeah.
Exactly. And the Wanyama situation, where I think it's only 2 years, but that kind of situation where, okay, now I'm bedded in at Celtic, I'm a regular at Celtic, now I'm in a Champions League, and I'm going to show the best clubs in Europe what I can do, and then I'm going to go. And it kind of seems to me, this is, you know, pretty poor psychology, and I don't know the guy at all, but it kind of seems to me that he almost needs to be motivated again. He needs Champions League football or something to kind of really be on his game and push for, you know, a big move. I might be wrong, but that's how it seems to come.
That would fit with my frustration that I believe that too many Celtic players are going through the motions. You know, like, I'm sure lots of people listening to this will have played a sport where they maybe, you know, are slightly better than the person they're playing against. And for whatever reason, they just are only able to motivate themselves to do just enough to beat the person they're playing. You know, whether it be you can play snooker with your mate and you're slightly better than your mate, and you just do enough because you know you can beat them, or whatever. Yeah. That's what the Celtic players look like to me this season. They, particularly in the last two or three months, they've looked to me like a team who know they're better than Aberdeen, know they will finish above Aberdeen, and are just doing what they need to do to get through to the end of the season.
Yeah.
Brown's a bit more of a concern. I'm a bit concerned that since in the last couple of games when Brown's come back from his injury, that he's either not fully fit or actually he's still not 100% fully recovered, because he can't be fully recovered, for example.
Yeah. Well, but even before then, to kind of add credence to that point of view, even before then, at the start of the season, both in the Champions League playoffs and in Scotland's away game in Georgia, he didn't have his best games, but that maybe kind of putting too much kind of coming to a conclusion a bit too easily, but.
But overall, do you know, actually, one of the things that I think I'm not getting much coverage and much talk, I do think the Celtic defence since Christmas has been markedly better than pre-Christmas.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the same bomb scare feeling about it.
Yeah. And although Skirchenko wasn't playing on Saturday, I think there is a solidity about Celtic when Skirchenko plays. And quite a few times you notice him kind of speaking to Boyata a lot, speaking to Tierney a lot, and it almost seems as though it's almost intangible, like when you're watching the defence, and but there is that kind of perception that it doesn't have that bomb scare kind of and part of it might be Sviatchenko's kind of communication, his reading of the game, cutting things out fairly early on. He's quite a solid passer, he's fairly comfortable with the ball at his feet as well, that perhaps Ambrose and Boyata sometimes give a ball away, or even if they don't give it away, maybe a pass goes 1 or 2 yards behind a fullback or something, and it kind of stops the momentum of a team. But for me, Svitchenko is a kind of profile of a player that Celtic should be going for. What, about 24, a bit of experience in a comparable league, maybe a slightly better league than our own. I think he was Danish Player of the Year that was announced the other week, I think. And for what, £2 million? I think that's a pretty good signing by Celtic.
And, which is then going to get onto to something I'm going to touch on, because from everything that I've heard, people talk about Ronnie Dyla's had X number of signings, and we can all, you know, famously, every good signing at Celtic was by Neil Lennon and every bad signing was Peter Lowell and John Park. However, it was Sviatchenko was Ronnie Dyla, same agent as Ronnie Dyla. And more or less, I was told it was the first player that 100% was chosen by Ronnie Dyla. You know, there's a football journalist, he's coming on our podcast soon, that I've had a bit of debate with, because he says, well, Ronnie Dyla signed Boyata and chose Boyata. To which I then say, well, did he sign Boyata, i.e. he had a list of 100 people and he chose Boyata, or did he sign Boyata on the premise of, you've asked for a centre-half, here's the three options we've got, Boyata, Danny Wilson and, Brian O'Neill. And under those circumstances, we would all choose Boyata. Doesn't mean that it's his first choice, it just means out of the three he was offered. And Sviatchenko was the first one that I understand that was 100% Ronnie Dyla's choice, which then gets me to say, so what the hell is going on with their signing, coaching, scouting strategy at the club if the other players who would be roundly criticised as not great signings in the last 18 months were came out of the preferred scouting signing strategy that the club's got? So what's your thoughts on the current scouting signing strategy that Celtic have got?
I think it would be difficult to apply a kind of a overall kind of coherence to every signing. Like, if it isn't kind of like, not every signing is buy to sell, because obviously you have Man City, Loney's, Denier, Roberts have come in. So obviously, if they're in the team and we don't get the resale on them, then obviously, you know, that's not a resale type signing.
Yep.
Signings that are kind of short term, such as Carlton Cole, and to a slightly lesser extent, but maybe short to middle term signing like Colin Kazim Richards, there isn't much resale in Kazim Richards, and there's none in Cole, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the City, and the kind of short term signings are obviously not resale. then the other players are kind of recruited from, you know, the other players I kind of go along with, like, even if they don't work out, at least if there's a kind of coherent logic to how we're operating. Yeah. And I'm for one who, you know, thinks that resale should be prioritised. I know in the last kind of 2 years or something, as maybe some signings haven't worked out, it's kind of people, maybe some Celtic fans are slightly annoyed at, you know, projects and all that kind of thing. But with the kind of income that Celtic has, I do think that we should be kind of, we should be prioritising players that do have resale and supplementing that with maybe it's Scottish players, supplementing it with kind of perhaps Svechenko won't have that high a resale, mm-hmm. but I think in a position such as centre-back, you do need a certain amount of experience. Okay, he's only 24, but he's been playing for that team, Michelin, for about 3-4 years. Mm-hmm. He's been playing for the Denmark national team. So he has a certain amount of experience too.
But also, you can slightly mix and match things in that, you know, your comment earlier of Svechenko seems to be speaking to people. So we've got Tierney, youngest Scotland debut for however many years. We've got Boyata, which despite, you know, St. Anthony on this site thinks he's I'm never in a million years a Celtic player. The fact is he's on the fringes of the Belgian squad. Yeah. So football people obviously think there's a football player in him. So I think you can justify a solid guy like Svechenko that maybe we sign him for a couple of million and he either stays, by which point actually it's been an okay buy for £2 million, or then we sell him at some point for £5 million, not been a great return. But if by having a good football brain, strong personality individual who develops Boyata and Tierney alongside him, that actually £2 million invested in him has added value to Boyata, then that can make sense.
Yeah, it can make sense. An element that I don't agree with the recruitment is the buying too many players in one position. And we've had it before with strikers where we've had so many that then we're sending others on loan, like Pukki's been on loan, Skepovic, Stokes, Shiki are currently on loan. We signed something like 20 or 21 strikers in the last, I think it's the last three seasons, mm-hmm. who are central strikers, not kind of a player like Commons or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a central striker. Now, obviously, people are commenting that in the kind of attacking midfield position, we probably have about eight or so players mm-hmm. for those three positions, possibly more. In fact, I think it is a bit more. If you have too many of those players and you're trying to do a resale kind of transfer policy, there aren't enough minutes on the pitch. There aren't enough positions on the pitch for collectively for those signings to make an overall profit. Mm-hmm. It's predicated to fail. If you have McGregor, Rodric, Armstrong, Mackay, Stephen, okay, Forrest might go in the summer, Roberts, Commons, there isn't enough minutes for them all to progress. Furthermore, you're splitting a pretty limited budget. If we want to be competing in Europe, mm-hmm. you're splitting a pretty limited budget over, for three positions, say, over, say, 8, 9, 10 players. I don't think that's effective. It's only my opinion, but I don't think it's effective. I don't think you would do it. I think it would seem absurd if you spend a decent amount of money on three different goalkeepers.
Yeah,
they can all develop, they can all raise in value, and that's effectively what we had been doing in a striking position, and what we're, in my opinion, what we're currently in a situation of as a kind of attacking midfield position.
I mean, your point about looking into the resale value, and I think most of us have accepted the financial climate of modern football, that for us to be able to participate at Champions League level, we have to accept that we're going to sign some. If we sign someone like Wanyama, we get him when he's still in the upwards trajectory and then have to sell him on. And most fans have accepted that. Equally, I think what frustrates a lot of fans is the concept that we are a bit like Arsenal, where they've now been, with it now been going to be a great team in 2 years' time for the last 15 years. That the concept of permanently signing, every signing being a project, I think, yes, we need to sign these players that we have a resale value, but equally we have to remember that we're a football club who wants to win trophies and play in European competition. So you also have to sign some people who are going to play first team football. And we just seem to, as you've just identified, we seem to have about four strategies going on at the same time at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
With none of them, it's not as if you can, like, so I could understand the first core strategy was, tell you what we're going to do, we are signing the best Scottish talent. We might drop in the odd guy who's got no resale value, parking with Cole's ability at the moment or whatever. We're going to sign the odd, more experienced player with no resale value, because you can't have a team that's one thing, so he's there to give some solidity, and we're going to have one or two players in the team who we all know are going to move on for a profit. But we seem to be trying to do all the strategies all at the same time as you then say we're spreading the resources. I mean, I keep saying about this lack of forethought strategy, particularly in terms of the strikers. I don't believe that Chiefchi, Kazim Richards, Cole are all superior to Skepovic, who we've got in our books and punted off on loan.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing about it's slightly unfair in calling Kazim Richards to lump him with the Cole signing, but because they're signed so close together and they're both free transfers, I'll do it. I'll be unfair. But it seems to me to be a kind of illogical or poor investment to say Cole was signed in October and he was given say a year and 9 month deal or something like that. Colin Kazim Richards was given a 2.5 year deal, I believe. Say, for argument's sake, they were both getting about 12.5 grand a week. Argument's sake, that's possibly conservative, but take away any signing fee, take that away and be conservative, that's still an outlay of £5 million. And we know that Griffiths is going to be our central striker.
Yep.
So we have two players, an investment of £5 million to be a second and third option to come onto a pitch if things aren't going well. You could possibly say that, okay, Colin Kazim Richards can also play as a kind of left side. But then, as we've already said,
a poor man's Georgios Samaras.
Well, yeah, exactly. And but then, as we've already said, we have about 10 players along that line of three anyway. So then that adds another player. Now, for a £5 million investment without any resale for two players to be an option for to come on for 15 minutes or to supplement the squad, or maybe to play, start 10, 15 games a season. For me, that money could have been spent better elsewhere.
Yeah, and so our strategy seems to be all over the place. And I don't know whether that's because we are finding it more difficult to pick up the value for money that we were picking up even just 3+ years ago in the likes of Van Dijk and Wanyama. You know, because famously, what is it, Chelsea have got, was it 30 players out on loan or something like that?
Yeah.
That if the top clubs are then just going, and you can understand that the rationale, if the top clubs are looking around and they're saying, well, we are getting to pick up a player for £10 million because Celtic have had him play 2 years of Champions League football. You can see why Man City might say, do you know what? Tell you what, we'll just cream up loads of talent and then try and loan them out to the clubs like Celtic and then just bring them back again. So that then leads to, if we can't pick up the value for money that we could pick up just 2-3 years ago, are we looking in the right place?
Well, I work for a company that...
Well, yeah, so I know what you do, so why don't you tell everybody listening what you're doing?
Whilst living in Argentina, I'm working for a company that identifies and analyses the best young players, principally in Argentina and Uruguay. We produce like scouting reports on these players with three main elements. We have, first of all, we have people who firsthand go to under 16, 17, under 18s, reserve and first team games in Argentina and Uruguay. So they're making first-hand reports on them. We then, the second element is that we use statistics. We look at them and analyse the players using statistics. And the third element is we have video footage. Now, yourself and probably a lot of the people know that Celtic use a system called Y-Scout. Mm-hmm. Most major clubs, even like Wickham Wanderers, will use Y-Scout.
Yep.
I think I have over 200 clubs who have signed up to them. And it's a really useful tool. If you want to see, for example, the left back of Steaua Bucharest, you click onto his profile and it will show you all the games he's played. You can then watch those games. It also shows you like maybe about a dozen to 15 elements of his game. So, for example, crossing, shots, through balls, stuff like that, which allows any club who signs up to the system to be able to do that, to watch every cross he's made, basically. Mm-hmm. What it doesn't do, it doesn't have any real depth in youth football or reserve football. So, for example, if you are looking in a competitive market, by the time, say for example, a club is looking at Spain or Argentina or Germany or whatever, and they're trying to buy a young player for resale value, they would then have to wait until that player is making first team appearances.
Yep.
Yes. You can still be able to, you know, find a good young player doing that, but you're only going to be competing with every other club in the world, basically, who's doing the same thing. But what my company is able to do, the company I'm working for, is we can give clubs a head start. So when the next Messi or Higuain or Aguero is coming up through the ranks, we can see them. We're at these games. I've been living in Argentina, as you know, for about 4 or 5 years now.
Uh-huh.
We've been going to these games, watching these players. And so we know who's coming through. And we have the video footage to show it, which Y-Scout doesn't have. Although Y-Scout is a very good tool, it doesn't have that. So it gives us, or it gives our clients a competitive advantage over people who don't have it, clubs who don't have it.
So the obvious question is, apart from one Mexican that we then set up a relationship with, and some poor Mexican tweets a good luck Celtic message once a week, why are we not looking in this continent for players? We've been to Asia, we've obviously all over Europe, not really Africa, and not South America, which is the obvious place to go.
Yeah, well, obviously I think that's something more for the club.
Yeah.
People who are making those decisions. Part of it may be that they haven't got access to watch the games, at least at youth reserve level. When they're starting in the Argentinian Premier League or the Uruguayan League, maybe Celtic then conclude it's too late.
Yep.
Porto are going to be in, the boy's going to be worth too much. Another possibility is the work permit situation and not having an EU passport, etc., etc. Now,
well, how do you overcome that? Because obviously, you know, that's one of the things that you and I have joked about on Twitter at times about, but can you get my passport? But how do you overcome the work permit issues?
Well, in the top 5 leagues in Europe, France, Spain, Italy, Germany and England, of all of the Argentinians that are playing in these leagues, 80% of them have EU passports.
Okay.
57% of Uruguayans have them. We were meant to be doing this meeting on Thursday, right? We're now recording on Monday.
Yep.
On Thursday, I had a meeting with an agent who works with Peñarol. Mm-hmm. And at the meeting, he basically had a profile of 4 players that he was offering. 3 of the players had a work permit, or they had an EU passport, sorry. 2 of the players are currently in the under-20s for Uruguay. Yep. One was in the under-20s last year, was captain, and now he's moved to the senior squad. He's been in the last 2 squads for World Cup qualification. So these players are wanting to sell them. They have EU passports, and they're within a price range of clubs in the lower reaches of the Premier League, I would assume Celtic, based on recent signings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, middling kind of clubs who have a kind of, you know, limited budget, who are spending £2 million on a player, basically.
Well, that's what I was going to... I was trying to go through what would be the things that people would say, well, this is the reason why people wouldn't come here. So first of all, do you think they would have an issue with Scotland? What I mean by that is, it's a bit of a backwater. It's the northern part of the shitty, you know, it's a shitty northern part of Europe in terms of weather and in terms of prestige and in terms of environment. So do you think these people would have it, would be averse to coming to Scotland in terms of it's a shitty place to come weather-wise, it's a shitty place to come in terms of prestige league-wise, etc.?
I believe that if you identify the players early enough and you're the club who comes in ready to sign them, ready with a contract before they have options that they would consider to be preferable to Celtic. Mm-hmm. I think if you identify them early enough, there's 2 things. You can get them because they want to go to Europe and they basically want to go to Spain or England. The second point is that they're then within Celtic's budget.
Yep.
And I'm just using Celtic as an example because we're in a Celtic podcast, but that would apply to, you know. For example, there was a player 2 years ago who I wrote a report on called Gaston Pereiro, who was playing for Nacional in Uruguay.
Yes.
He's now going to PSV for $4.9 million. Now, the report I made about Pereiro was 3 transfer windows before he went to PSV, when he was going to be available for $2 million. So what, £1.3 million or so? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Which, if you wait, say, 3 transfer windows, with something like 14 or 15 months, he then wins the Uruguayan league, he plays in the Copa Libertadores, so he has that international exposure that all the European clubs are watching. He then plays in the South American under-20s, where he's probably the second best player at that competition, and everyone was in Uruguay watching that competition. There's like 60 different clubs represented at that competition.
Okay.
So then, inevitably, his value goes up to the point where PSV Eindhoven are able to buy him for $4.9 million. Now, Eindhoven, PSV probably have quite a good reputation now in South America because they've been able to get Ronaldo, Romario, and now, you know, whole host of players like Ajax too. But I think that Celtic maybe have maybe underestimated, or maybe not underestimated, but I think Celtic could really take advantage of our position, being next to England, speaking English. In my point of view, we could be the best kind of club as a bridge to England. Because if a player goes to Porto or Benfica from, say, Uruguay or Argentina, the qualms that maybe an English club will have still exist, basically.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
They might have seen them in, you know, playing for Porto in the Champions League, but they still exist. They're still living in a Latin culture, climate, mm-hmm. Language.
Can he do it in a wet night in Stoke?
Exactly. They go to Scotland for 3 years. They learn English. They're playing. They're hopefully playing in the Champions League.
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously the reason Wanyama goes to Southampton isn't because he's scoring goals at Kilmarnock or Motherwell, because he's playing in the Champions League. So then you get 12, 13 million from him.
Yeah.
But they then culturally adapt, which is probably the biggest qualm they have still of a player at Benfica or Porto. And we get rid of all of that. If they adapt at Celtic and perform at Celtic in the Champions League, they're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we've taken advantage of our position.
Yeah, I mean, and in terms of selling ourselves to the player and his agent, you know, we've got Wanyama, we've got Van Dijk. Even though he was a Man City loanee, we've got Denier as examples of, by coming here, we were able to put them on the radar of English clubs. We were able to demonstrate to English clubs that they were capable of playing at a certain standard. And they're now playing in the top level in the English Premiership.
Yeah.
And whilst, you know, we like to see ourselves as a big club and you're loath to want to sell Celtic as a stepping stone, we have to accept for that type of player, he would only come to Celtic because it would give him the opportunity to get to England.
Yeah. Yeah. In the same way, a player at Benfica who are going to be playing, what, tomorrow night or Wednesday night against Bayern, the only reason he goes to Benfica is for that reason.
Yeah.
The reason why Suarez goes to Groningen and then goes to Ajax is for that reason.
Yeah. And that's where I would sort of say, going back to your comment of 15, 20 minutes ago about Celtic's strategy seems to have lost its way, that actually, up until this season even, I could see that was what we were building this narrative of, attracting that type of player to come here as a stepping stone to England. But none of the signings that we've made this season look to me like come here to go there.
There's obviously been a change, and part of that's been quite a lot of our budget has been put towards Scottish players as well. So there's obviously been a change in the direction that the club's going and the policy that they're using. I do think I'm slightly more positive though, because I can see the potential in Celtic. Like, and for example, when Miku signed for Celtic,
yep.
He was playing in La Liga. He had an offer from Swansea, and he wanted to come to Celtic instead of Swansea, apparently, according to himself, because we were going to be playing in the Champions League.
Yeah.
Which, for a South American, is the biggest stage, the biggest league they can play in. Obviously, they want to be in a, they would prefer to be in a Spanish or English club playing at that level. But a young 18-year-old boy from Montevideo, Buenos Aires, or wherever, they're probably not going to be signed by, you know, Chelsea and be starting for Chelsea. Or the logical step for them to take is to hopefully play in the Champions League and be noticed by those big clubs. It's a logical step for them to go in that stepping stone club.
So then, in order to do that, we need to be playing Champions League football.
Yep.
Do you think we have a squad that's capable of playing Champions League football at the moment?
No, but I don't think it's maybe is. I don't think they're playing to the kind of sum of their parts.
Right.
I think there's actually, like, I think Beaton can be a very good player. In fact, I was thinking about earlier today, I was thinking about Celtic's performances in Europe, and I was thinking about our game away at Spartak Moscow. Mm-hmm. And in that game, we were kind of playing a 4-3-3, 4-5-1, and we had Lustig on the right, Izaguirre on the left, and I believe it was Kelvin Wilson and possibly Ambrose at the back, but I might be wrong at that. Mm-hmm. I believe that was the case. We had Mulgrew and Wanyama as the two holding midfielders, and basically Mulgrew would just kind of close down a lot of play, and we had Brown in front of them, whose task was to go on their defensive midfielder, who's quite a classy player, and just smother him. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking about the current players that we have, and I was thinking it's actually not that different.
Yep.
Like, player for player, that team is probably a bit better because you have Foster in goal, who I think is a bit better, and like, he is better than Gordon. Wanyama's gone. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, but it's not as like to win away in Spartak Moscow to our current results.
Yep.
I don't think the difference in the two teams that you could put out are that great. Like, so in short, basically, I've been digressing a bit. In short, I think we're maybe only about three players away, good players, from being a fairly kind of competitive team again.
Well, two things about that. One, I like Griffiths, and I think Griffiths has done a great job. My slight issue with Griffiths is when he's played for Scotland or he's played for Celtic in Europe, he has looked not at that level.
He doesn't hold the ball up very well still.
I'm trying to say in a nice way.
Yeah, but in my opinion, that still wasn't Hooper's best attribute either. Hooper had a nice touch, but he couldn't cover that much ground. You basically had to play it like right into him.
Yep.
Like,
then the other part, that comes down to the coach or manager, doesn't it?
Yeah. That Celtic team wouldn't have been caught on, to use a football jargon, on the transitions.
Yep.
That much. They were a pretty solid, like, Izaguirre and Lustig would support, in these European away games, they would support the kind of Samaras ahead of them, or Commons in that game ahead of them, but it wasn't that often that they were, you know, like 15 yards, going 15 yards beyond them in a way that we were seeing maybe in some of the games this year, where you have Boyata playing the ball out of defence. Boyata is, you know, he's a competent player, but he's maybe not the best passer, in my opinion. And you have the two fullbacks who are basically on the halfway line.
Yep.
And if that pass goes astray, then you're in trouble.
So, if you're saying the existing team is not as far off that team as we currently think, I think most Celtic fans are probably in the position of, we accept that there will be some form of mutual pattern of the weeks between Celtic and Ronnie Dial in the summer. No point in getting, no point in asking. I think most Celtic fans have calmed down about the Dial must go thing, those who are most vociferous, because I think there's an understanding of what we need to do is win this cup semi-final, win the league, win the cup final. I think most people are thinking there just will be a change in the summer.
Yeah.
So what's the point in getting knickers in a twist? So if there is going to be that change in the summer, not who in terms of the person, because you might not have an encyclopedic review of every manager that you possibly get, but who in terms of the CV, what's the CV you would want in the next Celtic manager?
A few times I've said this, but I think, I don't think it's that logical when, but what's the big differential for Celtic, right, Harry? What's the big differential for Celtic?
We play European football.
Exactly.
We want to be playing Champions League football.
And we commonly, if not always in the last decade, appoint a manager who has no European experience or very little European experience.
I'm trying to think of the last Celtic manager who, prior to his appointment, did have reasonable European experience.
Venglos?
Venglos, yeah. Venglos was the last Celtic manager. Because
yeah.
Martin didn't. Strachan didn't. Mowbray didn't. Lennon didn't.
And both financially and in a sporting sense, this is absolutely key to Celtic. You have these very important, vital games for Celtic in July and August with a manager who has never played in European competition before. I think only from that basis, like, it just seems illogical to me that you would then look at people who have outperformed on their budget in Europe, or who have very good records qualifying for a Champions League. That just seems logical to me.
Yep.
Now, and especially when you offer it and you say, look, our budget, our wage budget is, what, $35 million a year on the squad.
Yep.
I think, I remember at a time looking at Malmo's previous year's accounts, and it was, our budget was going to be seven times their accounts. Or their similar budget. Now, to be fair, they then won the league, so they would have had a bonus, and they then signed the Peruvian left back, which kind of adds to the point that South Americans will go anywhere.
Yep.
So their budget was probably a bit higher than the accounts I'd seen from the previous year that had been published. But the point is that everyone who we're going to be playing is going to have a lesser budget than us. For a lot of European coaches, I think that would be an appealing thing.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to take this, huge club, is going to be packed out 60,000 every night in a Champions League, and we're going to try and re-establish ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it was. I was watching Sky Sports at the weekend, and it said something about the Chelsea game, and there's a picture of Gus Hiddink, and I thought, do you know, it's hard to believe. He agreed to take the Celtic job, and we knocked him back.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't imagine that stature of coach coming to. I mean, I know football's changed. That's the point I keep making of, you know, Chris Sutton would cost us, the equivalent of Chris Sutton would cost us £25 million in today's. And multiplying up his transfer of 30 million quid and be on £90,000 a week. So football's changed, but I do think we can afford a better quality coach. You know, I think if all the sort of stuff, if you read the numbers game and Soccernomics, they talk about a football coach makes maybe 15% difference. Well, that 15% difference is Champions League football. For us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Champions League football for us, everybody accepts, is £20 million?
Yeah.
Well, Ronnie Dyer and Neil Lennon have both been on, what, £500,000 a year? So, I'm not saying we go for him, but I do know that a sort of a Davy Moyes level of manager, which might be the equivalent that we're seeking in Europe, Davy Moyes' salary at Everton was, I think he's in the bracket of looking for a £2 million, £2.5 million job. Well, I understand why we have a salary cap on the players, because once you pay one guy, that can have an impact on 15 guys' salaries. But paying the manager £2 million quid doesn't have an impact on the playing squad. And I think we can afford to pay £2 million for a manager whose 15% difference gets us playing Champions League football. It's 10% of the uplift. Yeah. I think that's a reasonable deal.
Yeah.
And I think we could get the type of coach that you're talking about if we were saying you've got a football budget of 30 million quid and your personal salary is 2 million quid. And give him a £1 million bonus for hitting the group stages of Champions League.
Yeah.
It just seems relatively straightforward to me. I mean, I know I said I'm not expecting you to pick a person, but do you have any type of person, you know, in mind?
There was the guy, Jovanovic. In fact, I mentioned this in the end of year review last time, and Lawrence Donegan started shouting out, "Football hipster, football hipster."
That's right.
But, no, I don't even know that much about this guy. It just kind of, it's always in my head that this guy, I think Ivan Jovanovic, he was with Apoel in Cyprus, and with a £7 million budget, he got them through. He didn't even qualify them to the last 16. He then beat Lyon in the last 16, and then they're playing Real Madrid. And they were in the Champions League, I think, 2 years in a row. Were pretty good. That name just kind of is always in my head. And another one that is going to completely contradict my previous thing about specifically European experience.
Yep.
But he does have a lot of national and international and intercontinental experience is the ex-Chile boss, Sampaoli. Mm-hmm. Remember at a World Cup, there was a little Chilean manager, a bald guy.
Yes, I do, yeah.
He resigned from Chile about 6 months ago and has been in the papers since then saying that he wants to have a long-term project, and that he wasn't even interested in, and this is almost a direct quote, he wasn't interested in taking an elite club in Europe. He wanted to beat the elite clubs in Europe from afar, and he wants a long-term project. Now, this guy has won the equivalent of the UEFA Cup with a Chilean team. He was in the FIFA kind of whatever World Player of the Year thing they have, that Ballon d'Or. He was named as one of the top three managers for this year. He won the Copa America for Chile, first time they've ever done it, beating Argentina. He knocked out Spain in a World Cup. He's something about 43, 44, 45, something like that. Quite a young manager. This is, like, I'm not saying that Celtic are going to get him, but at least, you know, like, I think we should be kind of looking at this as someone who wants to have a long-term project and, you know, thinking seriously and, you know, inquiring, getting into talks with him. Like, Boca Juniors were in talks with him the other day, and just had a meeting with him before they appointed their new manager to kind of gauge, you know, what he wanted to do. So I think it would be good for Celtic, almost like the, you know, dialogue decision to, you know, think out of the box, think creatively. Obviously, a lot of talented people out there.
I suppose that the only thing you got to balance off, Gordon Strachan's capable of getting us to the last 16 in the Champions League. But people weren't happy with the style of football that he played domestically.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing you've got to try and, I suppose, balance off. Someone who can get is there, but someone who's going to play in a certain way, and that's a bit more challenging.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing, just digressing here, just thinking about Strachan, was now Strachan seems to be kind of dogmatic about playing this 4-2-3-1 formation.
Yeah.
Whereas at Celtic, he was quite dogmatic about having two banks of four, quite a flat midfield.
Yep.
And then, you know, Vinegar, Heslink, and maybe McDonald up front or something. And just thinking back, if you think about, had he have been dogmatic about playing 4-2-3-1 with Celtic, with the squad he had at Celtic, and he would have had Maloney on the left, Nakamura in the centre, and McGeady on the right, with maybe a big guy like Vinegar of Heslink who can hold the ball up, allowing for those three to nip in, and, yeah, you know. That is ideal, with like two of Brown, Hartley, Robson, yeah, there's also Gravison and Jarasic kind of around the squad, but two of those three Scottish players to kind of do, you know, like cover the ground behind them. That's a pretty it would have been such a good option had he been open to playing a 4-2-3-1. Anyway, I'm just
no, but it's interesting actually, because that's one of the other things that one of the disappointments for me, and I don't know whether, you know, getting back to once Strachan came in, he became dogmatic to a system. One of the things that I liked when Dyla came in was hearing all the stuff of he was a young manager who always was wanting to learn and do things different and change, and he'd gone around. And the only thing that I was wondering the other day is part of Ronnie Dyla's problem being once he arrived at Celtic, he didn't feel he had the, you know, he had to get in and just do it because he was now at the big club. Did he stop learning? Did a guy whose big thing was continual learning, did he stop learning? Has that been the problem?
For me, something I really like, and almost the way I'll try and judge a manager, is how well I think the team and the players are adhering to the idea. So, like, you'll watch Atletico Madrid, and you see them, and maybe stylistically or whatever, they're not amazingly attractive to watch, and they're completely different to how Barcelona play.
Yeah.
But you know they're all adhering exactly to what Simeone wants.
Yep.
They're covering every blade of grass when they get the ball, they're retaining the ball, you know, against, you know, high pressing of Barcelona the other day, they're retaining it, getting throw-ins, bringing the team up the pitch. And that's what I love to see. I love to see a team kind of adhering to an idea. And that's been probably my most kind of, the most disappointing thing about Dyla for me, being that I don't see a kind of, you know, really clear, coherent idea of, like, if he wants to play high pressing, okay, well, he came in kind of saying he wanted to play high pressing, but now I don't, like, yeah, you see pressing, but almost like, you know, any team, you know, yeah, some people closing down and whatever, but I don't see this kind of, you know.
And that's one of my things, in that the second half of last season, we did seem to be evolving into playing the way that he'd been talking, you know, he'd been talking since he came in about playing a certain way.
Yeah.
And from January onwards, you thought, actually, we're now starting to play like that. We're starting to look like we're now, the players have now bought in, and I was expecting from the beginning of this season onwards that we would go from the way we played at the end of last season.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. I mean, the thing that really struck me in the Hearts game was, Hearts were doing well against us in the first 15 minutes because they were playing this high pressing game.
Yeah.
Suddenly, we did it, and all three of our goals came from pressing them.
Mm-hmm.
And it made them stop pressing us because they became too focused on defending our pressing.
Oh.
But the reason it really struck me was because it was rare.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's why. And it happened to a greater extent, it happened once Rodri went off, Beaton came on, and Johansson went back into that number 10 position, because Johansson's the only player who does it on a regular basis. And you can't be a one guy when you want to do pressing in that type of pressing. You can't do it. It's got to be the front 3-4 do it.
It has to be every.
So yes, I suppose whenever we have what we all expect of this mutual leaving of Ronnie Dyla, my biggest disappointment will probably be, well, over two disappointments. Did he stop learning and evolving? And two, did the players decide at some point, beginning of this season in particular, we're not into this?
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually just making, he was just making the best of a bad situation. That's what it's felt like this season. We're all just muddling through to the end of the season.
Yeah.
But talking of the end of the season, before we get to the end of the season, we have a cup semi-final on Sunday against a team who, because they've won the championship, their cheerleaders and the media think that they are on a par with Celtic. So I don't know, because I genuinely have watched a maximum of half an hour of football of Rangers on, not even that, 20 minutes of football of new Rangers under Warburton. So I couldn't tell you how they play. What are you expecting from the game on Sunday?
It may surprise you, but there isn't that much coverage of Rangers in South America.
No, you mean when Fox signed up?
It's an absolute disgrace.
The SPL to play the championship.
I've seen two games of Rangers, of the new Rangers. The very first game 4 years ago, when a ball got stuck in a hedge.
Yep.
And the game against us, when we sleepwalked to a 2-0 win.
Yeah, we played with our hands in our pocket second half.
Yep.
So what's your expectation?
My expectation is another 2-0 win, but it to be a bit more competitive. But still another 2-0 win. Long term, I'm maybe not quite as complacent as some Celtic fans that I read on Twitter. Because just on the basis of if Scandinavian clubs such as Molde and Malmo with a small budget can match us and beat us, I think that even though now Rangers are going to have a smaller budget than us for, you know, the foreseeable future.
Yep.
But even with this smaller budget, they're going to have a larger budget than the other teams in the SPFL. And I remember I grew up in England, I grew up outside London, and quite often, you know, the boring conversation, how would Celtic and Rangers get on in the English League? It's a weekly, almost daily conversation I'd have at school. And at that time, this was like O'Neill's teams against, say, McLeish and Abercat's teams.
Yeah.
And in my view, Celtic squad, the Larson O'Neill squad, was more or less the same level as, say, Liverpool, who were about third in the league then. That was about our level, I thought. I thought that Rangers' squad was about the level of a Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
When they had one or two half decent players and the rest were nothing.
Yeah.
The problem is that if you're then playing against other teams that are mediocre to poor, Bolton, for example, if you put in Liverpool and Bolton into League One, the third tier in England, Bolton and Liverpool are going to be more or less neck and neck at the end of the season.
Like us in Aberdeen this season and last.
Yeah.
We're not doing dramatic. I mean, I think one of the things I did earlier this, certainly, I think it was this season, where I pointed out that normally the third place team finish, or the third place team in Scotland have been over the previous, you know, when the Rangers existed, were finishing on average something like 17 points behind.
Yeah.
The league winners, and Aberdeen had finished 17 points behind us.
Yeah.
But when you chucked into the mix that when there were both Celtic and Rangers in the league, the third place team was usually dropping 9 or 10 points to the second place team.
Yeah.
Actually, if you'd taken those 9-10 points, the point I remember making was Aberdeen, actually, if you put those 9-10 points back off Aberdeen, Aberdeen finished further behind us last season than a third place team normally finish. The difference was they stayed on our coattails for longer because they were just beating everybody else. We didn't proportionately finish that much different to where we would normally finish in terms of number of victories over the rest of the league. The difference was, and it's the reason why for years I've thought there should be an 18-team top flight, because next season, for example, Aberdeen will have Celtic and Rangers to beat in addition to themselves.
Yeah.
They will go 4 games before they play Celtic and 4 games, and then another 4 games, and then they play Rangers. Whereas this season, they've gone, played Celtic, 9 games, played Celtic. So they get more of an opportunity to go on a momentum and a winning run. So your point of, actually, you can be a million, you can be quite a chunk behind us, but if you're beating everybody else, you can be on our coattails.
I think that's, I would assume that Rangers are going to be around about where Hearts Hearts are. First season, second season, I would think that it's going to almost look as though there's a title race, but it's not going to be a serious title race. It's going to be like Aberdeen. But eventually I think if they get, if you buy well and you have a budget that's better, greater than everyone else's, and you buy, you know, adequately well, then you know, you're probably going to be within 6-7 points of us. So it's going to look as though there's a title race. But with regards to Sunday, I think it'll be competitive, but we have, one of the good things is that we have quite good quality Scottish players who will know what it means. Better quality. Brown, Griffiths will be up for the game. Which is a bonus. Beaton last time, in the last Rangers game, absolutely walked it. He was just a level above them. So hopefully a lot of energy from Johansson closing them down, Beaton passing them off the pitch, and Griffiths hitting a few goals, 2 goals maybe, and it should be, you know, competitive but, you know, comfortable at the same time.
Okay, well, hopefully you're right with your 2-0. And with that, I will see Mark Cooper. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brian. Hi.
That's all right.
Laugh me a laugh, grin me a grin, and then I know that.
I hope you found that podcast interesting and informative. If you're not already following Mark on Twitter, he can be found at Marco Cooper. That's MarkoCooper. And he is giving his insight regularly into Celtic from his base down there in Buenos Aires, and also one or two wee insights that you may have picked up on the podcast. Coming up in next week's podcast, and yes, there is going to be a next week, so there won't be the same massive gap, is someone who's just done a book on the events of 30 years ago. Yes, for those of a certain age, Albert Kidd Day was 30 years ago, and the day where our 5-0 victory at St Mirren, allied to Dundee's 2-0 victory at home against Hearts, gave us a title that many were not expecting just a few weeks earlier. In fact, on the morning of the game, many were not expecting. And in that 5-0 victory, obviously had one of the best goals I've ever seen
Celtic score. So that's next week, which ties in with the event that the Celtic FC Foundation are holding to commemorate that. There's a dinner on the 1st of May. I think there's some spaces still available if you want to attend. Also, just bits and pieces, we had the John Fallon book, so congratulations to Paul Callaghan, who's won that book, and it's been posted out to you already. Anyway, enough of me. Get yourselves onto the Celtic FC Foundation website to find out what the charitable arm of the club are doing. Get yourself along to the Albert Kidd Memorial Dinner if you want, or just listen to the podcast. It's an interesting guest with interesting times. Anyway, enough of me. That was me, Harry Brady, with him, Mark Cooper, saying good night and God bless. Good night. Follow me through into the sun, and we can smile at everyone. You gotta join in with me, then we are free. It isn't hard to do. I said life is a song, so just sing along, and then we know we can't go wrong. Just you and me, come on and see, together we'll be okay.